Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Clones, what's going on? Welcome to the Daily Jungle. Huge day in the jungle because we are back in Portland. And you better believe that PDX represented strong today. Also, the NFL has dropped the hammer with multiple suspensions this week. You'll get my take on what they need to do next. Willie Taggart just left Oregon for Florida State. We covered that. Plus, UAB head coach Bill Clark came in after his amazing season. Bleacher Report's Tom Haberstroh was excellent. And Icarus filmmaker Brian Fogel came in to discuss the huge news that Russia is out of the Winter Olympics. Allegedly. Alvy, a warrior, bouncing back from the flu less than 24 hours after getting it. Go ahead, Alvin. Roll it. But in terms of the suspensions, my thing about this is you've got similar crimes. And then you have a crime that does not match the other crimes. And then you had the punishment, which was all the same. And now the punishment is not the same. I know it sounds convoluted. Rob Gronkowski appealed his one-game suspension. That was rejected. Juju Smith-Schuster had a one-game suspension announced. His appeal was rejected. George Iloka had a suspension announced. And his appeal was to be heard. And I assumed that it would be rejected, but it was not. It was accepted. So Iloka is not going to be suspended, but Juju Smith-Schuster is, and so is Gronk. So the issue to me, the NFL's biggest problem right now is consistency. And consistency in the way they call that. What is suspendable and what is not? What is illegal versus what is dirty and what is not? And it seemed pretty clear to me. My initial argument was Gronk is skating. What Gronk did was dirty, and it was cheap. It might have been out of character, and it might not be. He's not a dirty player. He's not a bad guy or a dirty player, but that was a dirty play, and that was not a football play. The other two, while illegal, were actual football plays. So how can you justify the two of them having the same punishment as Gronk? But come to find out, those two didn't get the same punishment. So why is it that Iloka's helmet-to-helmet hit was not a suspendable offense, but Juju Smith-Schuster's was? That, to me, doesn't make sense. My feeling is either you suspend them both or you don't suspend either of them if you want to justify it like that. So the thinking is, John Runyon of the NFL was asked about this, and here's how he explained it. Runyon said this about Juju Smith-Schuster, quote, "He lined up a defender. He delivered a violent and unnecessary blind shot to his head and neck area and then celebrated the play by standing over him and taunting him." All right, so he lined him up. Did he line him up? I mean, I know the league's trying to get rid of crackback blocks like that, but did he line him up? I think part of what's hurting him are the optics. He stood over him and he taunted him. Had he not done that, would he have been suspended? Maybe not. And what's the difference also? Antonio Brown made the catch and popped right up. He didn't leave on a board like Vontaze Burfict did. So how much of this is about optics? How much of this is about the result? If Antonio Brown doesn't get up, I think we're looking at suspension, right? If Iloka is standing over him and he didn't get up, we're talking about a suspension, right? But are we finding the reaction or are we finding and suspending the play itself? And how much of this is about the NFL reacting to the way everybody else is reacting? The NFL's biggest problem here is consistency. The players don't know what is a suspendable hit and what's not. Really, nobody does. I'm not even sure the league does. How do you explain that? So they got a real problem there. I mentioned there's another suspension. This one's not from the league, though. Adam Schefter reports the Chiefs are suspending cornerback Marcus Peters for Sunday's game against the Raiders. Remember, he took that flag and he threw it 20 rows up in the stands. So they're suspending one of their best players because he melted down during a game. They're suspending one of their own when they've got a must-win game against a division rival that they're tied with in the AFC West. And they're not going to have this guy. They're not going to have Peters. They're suspending their own player because he melted down and he snapped.
Incomplete in the end zone, but a flag down. It's going to be another Kansas City penalty. And now we're going to get a player most likely ejected from the game. Because what? A Kansas City Chiefs player, Marcus Peters, picked up the official's flag, and he threw it up into the crowd. That's how upset Kansas City is at yet another penalty called against their team in their end zone. Marcus Peters, he can head to the locker room right now. He's done.
So Marcus Peters picked up the flag, threw it into the stands, and now the Chiefs are suspending him. And why do you think they're doing that? Why do you think they're doing that? Because the team is out of control, and especially him. Super gifted player. Great, great talent. Obviously, and there's been a lot of speculation and reports, Mike Freeman had it in his column in Bleacher Report, that this guy has been out of control, in effect. That he's not been able to discipline him, and that he's taking liberties, and they're letting him get away with these things. They're letting him get away with it. Mike Freeman mentioned that there was a source that compared him to Odell Beckham. So if they're going to sit this guy down before a game that important, clearly they're trying to send a message. You can't have one set of rules for a guy like that and a set of rules for everybody else. It's getting away from Andy Reid. Otherwise, you don't sit that guy down before a game like that after he was penalized in that game already. They're trying to send him a message, trying to send the locker room a message, trying to get control of their situation. And that's all on Peters, by the way. That's not on Reid. That's not on the team. Peters put himself and that team in that position. That's all on him. And now they're in a bad spot. Now they're in a game they have to win, and they're going up against the Raiders without their best corner. So another suspension right there. Bill Clark. Bill, it's great to have you back. How are you?
I'm good, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing great, Bill. Great to visit. Now, when you and I spoke in August before the start of the program's first season back, I had to get you back on now because you did complete that first season. I've got to ask first, what was this season like for you?
Well, you know, I think it was a learning experience early on for our guys. You know, you're talking about guys that had not played a lot of them had never played an FBS game. You know, we had a lot of junior college guys. We had former high school players, and we had a very few guys that had actually been in the FBS game. So the first home game, the first road trip, you know, we had all these firsts. And so I think they were just every week was a learning experience, and we got better every week. And really those last five or six games, I thought we played really well, and we're playing our best football at the end.
You know, I would imagine that going into the season, it was pretty clear that you felt confident your guys were not just going to show up, but they were going to compete. What did you see in them during the offseason and the buildup to the regular season that gave you that feeling?
Well, I think they started to come together as a team. You know, we had guys from all over the country, and I think that was one of the biggest things when you got guys from every, you know, geographic location, from California to Texas to New York to Alabama to Florida. You know, it's just a lot of different, not just personalities, but really just the way they were brought up. And I think bringing those guys together and having a common goal of making history and bringing this program back the right way, playing for more than yourself, you know, all the things that we want them to believe in and do, I think they started really coming together. And I saw that this off season, and you know, they wanted to do more than just show up and play. I think they really wanted to, you know, they expected to win, wanted to win, and really and competed hard.
Bill, stay on that point for a minute, because that's a really diverse roster. You've got a roster that's got players from junior colleges, as you point out. You've got seven guys from Texas, nine from California, a punter from Australia. So when you've got a locker room full of players with all different backgrounds like that, how do you go about getting them to buy into that same shared vision?
Yeah, I think that is a great question. You know, I think all of us coaches think if we practice hard and we do all these things, good things are going to happen. And everybody's doing that. I do think, you know, one of the things I try and we try and talk about every day is really, you know, playing for more than yourself. One of the greatest things about football, obviously, is we are all so dependent upon each other for our success. And, you know, you've got to have each other. And I think those guys learned to maybe take away a little bit of the me mentality. And you know, I say this about junior college lifestyle, and it, not even in a bad way. It's just, it can be very, you know, mercenary-like, because each guy's got to be his own self-promoter. And, you know, then we've got to go change that mindset and make it all about UAB and our team and our city and our school. And I think just for them to play for this return and how hard our fans and, you know, our supporters fought just to get this program back, and, you know, along with things like giving back to, you know, the Children's Harbor and the Big Brothers and the things where they learn to, to be selfless. I think hopefully all those things helped them come together as a
team. Clones, how about you sharing a second with me so I can talk to you about something very important, Stamps.com. Listen, these days, you can get practically everything on demand, such as our podcast. Listen whenever you want, when it's convenient for you. So let me ask you, why are you still going to the post office and dealing with their limited hours when you can get postage on demand with Stamps.com? Anything that you can do at the post office, you can now do right from your desk. As an example, the holidays are coming up. My wife, Janet, is all about the Christmas card. We send out hundreds, literally hundreds of Christmas cards, and there's no way we could do it without Stamps.com. I'm going to print my own postage. I'm going to do it when I want and do it at home. Trust me, with the holidays coming up, you should do the exact same thing, and you'll thank me for it. Go to Stamps.com, hit the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Jungle. That's Stamps.com, enter Jungle for a special, special offer. A 4-week trial, which includes postage and a digital scale. Do not wait. You want to go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, hit the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Jungle. That's Stamps.com, enter Jungle. Stamps.com, never go to the post office ever again. I know I won't. That's Stamps.com. Now it's back to our Daily Jungle. UAB head coach Bill Clark is my guest. You mentioned the fans. After you beat Rice, a fan handed you a green bowl with stickers on it that read, bowl eligible. You brought that bowl with you to the press conference. What did that moment mean to you?
Oh, gosh, it was just huge. I think people really don't understand, you know, and nobody probably knows anybody's job, whether it's if I was talking about all the things that go into your job or anybody's job, just how hard, you know, each job can be. And, you know, college football is just so competitive. And when people, you know, really lose their jobs over winning and losing, everybody's got the same amount of scholarships, basically. And, you know, just to get bowl eligible is such a big deal in a normal year, much less when we're returning from not even having a program. So that was huge. And it was kind of a funny moment, but symbolic of, you know, just kind of what this group's accomplished and a big deal.
Yeah, it's so true. The program goes away and then it comes back and then you're bowl eligible. But it's not just a bowl. It's a bowl game, but it's the Bahamas Bowl, which means you're going to go international. AD Mark Ingram said, quote, "From my perspective, if there's a team in the country that deserves a reward trip, it's our team. I'm thrilled for them to have what I think is a trip of a lifetime," end quote. I mean, it's so true. So what's it mean to see all that hard work pay off for your guys in a trip like that?
You know, I don't know if it really could get much better. I mean, to get to take these guys on a, you know, from the 18th to the 22nd to a paradise. And, you know, I was real lucky. I got to go there a couple years ago with my wife as, you know, kind of representative of Conference USA the year, first year we weren't playing. And to see it, I had been there one other time. They're going to do everything right. It's a big deal to the Bahamian people, you know, to represent our conference. And, you know, it's played on the 22nd. So it's such a good time. I really just can't say how great it is for our guys and what a reward for them. And then obviously a game against a really quality opponent, you know, to, you know, just another measuring stick for us. So we couldn't be more excited.
UAB coach Bill Clark joining me for a few more moments. I thought senior linebacker Shaq Jones said something really interesting, Bill. He said, quote, "It's easy to get up out of bed because it's an exciting time here at UAB. I'm always eager to get up and go because at one time we didn't have football," end quote. So when you've got a senior like Shaq Jones who stayed and believed in the program when he could have left, what message does that send to your younger players and the players that you're recruiting?
I hope it sends everything about what we want to be about. You know, Shaq is the guy that epitomizes that. He did stay. He believed in this place. And, you know, that's kind of what I would say in recruiting. Okay, if you don't know anything about our staff or what's going on here in Birmingham or UAB as a school, you know, this guy stayed. He chose to be around. He chose just to practice when he could. And he had tons of other people that wanted him, you know, after we got through playing in 14. You know, he was a good player in 14. He's got all the measurables. And he chose to stay. So hopefully that says everything about who we are and kind of where we're headed.
So final thought. Earlier this season, you agreed to a 5-year extension with the school, and it was not that long ago that the school didn't even have a program, and now you're signing an extension. How do you explain how all of this has worked out the way that it has?
Well, we're blessed, you know, and I talk a lot about faith, and I don't like to beat people over the head with that, but I have my personal faith, and then I just the faith in the people around here, you know, is really strong. Our fans and what they stand for. And I say this all the time, you know, we, we've got such a great group of people around here that really believe in UAB and kind of what we're trying to get done. So, you know, that just the contract extension just says where we're headed, we're here to stay, and we're going to do it right.
But the big story right now, I say this a lot, the biggest topic in the jungle is off in the jungle. The biggest topic right now is the return of Portland. 102.9, 750 the game. I am pumped. Listen, affiliates come and go in syndicated radio. So it's awesome to be back on in the 971. Now, we did lose PDX for a few months earlier this year. And at that time, the blower was off the hook with calls from people in the market looking for the show. Now, what's interesting is, and something else, look, again, I know what you're thinking before you think it. If you're outside of Portland, I know what you're thinking. If you're inside of Portland, you're thinking, hey, Rome, good to have you back. Or a few of you are probably thinking, damn, Rome, it was great without you. One or two of you were thinking that. One or two of you were thinking, hey, Rome, it was awesome without you. Bad news, I'm back. Now, a lot of you are thinking, it's good to have you back, and we have to make up for last time. That's what you're thinking if you're in the PDX. If you're outside of Portland, I know exactly what you're thinking. If you're listening to this show, anytime anyone hears the word Portland, they immediately go to their default setting. Their default setting being a reset of Portland woman. You know, on the one hand, I can't really say that I blame you. Because although I can't get with that call, I don't condone that call, it was a pretty memorable call. There's an important point to be made after the fact, and I'm going to make that point. But first, here's why people think of, quote, Portland woman whenever Portland comes up in this show. It's because Brandon from Portland made this phone call back in 2014 describing what he thinks is a certain kind of woman in his city.
Well, you know what? We got this phenomenon up here in Oregon, and I call it Portland woman. Portland woman, she doesn't shave, she doesn't clean up. They put her on TV. Turn on any Portland channel with the local show. You'll find Portland woman showing off her stuff, gray hair, no makeup, all the wrinkles to boot, and the clothing is something else. You can see the stain. So, anyways, to Portland woman, please, please, do us all a favor and clean it up. That's all I got, Romy.
Yo, is that all, Brandon? Is that all you've got, Brandon? Nothing else? Let's be really clear about this, and don't get it twisted. I don't condone that. I don't agree with that. I don't respect that. That's not what I'm about. I've been doing this for upwards of 30 years. We have over 200 stations on this network. I've been to so many of these markets. Trust me, I've seen Portland woman, San Francisco woman, San Diego woman, LA woman, Detroit woman, Buffalo woman, San Antonio woman, and I've seen dudes in all these markets too. This is not unique to that market, what he described. So I can't condone that on any level. Let me just be very clear about that. Now, having said that, I cannot tell you how many people have come in demanding a reset of Portland woman since I made the announcement a half hour ago that we're back on the air in Portland. Now, the thing is, while you were gone, Portland, it was not the same without you. It just wasn't. The jungle is much better with Portland, Oregon. But I noticed something while you were gone. Portland, Maine, for whatever reason, tried to step up and pick up the slack. Portland, Maine, a city of 67,000, was showing up consistently and representing. It's almost like they figured out, like, all right, they're gone. Big brother Portland, Oregon's gone. We'll step it up. Like, take Eric in Portland, Maine. This guy teed off on Gronk for cheap-shotting Tre'Davious White. This call just came in.
What a disgusting display. I've been watching football a long time. That was a... I mean, I've heard the word classless and dirty hit thrown around. I think that's an understatement. It was premeditated. It was malicious. There was intent to injure, a successful intent to injure. You gave the guy a concussion. It was disgraceful. It really was. I'm actually shocked Gronk didn't get hurt on the play. The guy's about as durable as a dandelion. He's made out of balsa wood. But no ejection. That's the other. No ejection. Any other team in the league, except for the one that hails from Fraudborough, the good old Patsy. No ejection. Gene Steratore standing there like a mannequin, like he usually does during Pats games. Which, by the way, he referees about 75% of their games.
All right. So a good straight take from this week. In fact, the huge call today on Monday. All right. So if I mention Portland, Oregon, and you think of Portland woman. And again, I don't. If I mention Portland, Maine, what do you think of? Maybe Tim from Portland, Maine. You know, the guy who went fake silk in the 2013 Smack Off?
Tim in Portland.
Yeah, first I got to say thanks to Silk for letting me call in his spot in the Smack Off. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's pretty funny, actually.
Hopefully you'll invite me in this year, and I'll actually be able to call in on my own merits. You still there, Jimmy?
Yeah, I am, but you're not.
That's not a good call. No.
Don't make this any more difficult than it's already not.
You remember that guy? He called in and pretended to be Silk. And was just going, brah, come on.
Come on.
Come on.
Come on.
Portland, Maine. So, Portland, Maine never left. Portland, Oregon is back. We've got both Portlands, and it's great to have you both. Jack to be back on in Portland, Oregon. 102.9, 750 the game. Portland, Maine picked up the slack while you were gone. Portland, Oregon. But now you're back, and that's all that matters. Dear Rome, let me be the first to welcome Portland woman back to the jungle. Thanks. Excessive arm hair and bad breath. Weekly bathing, tattered and stained clothing. Matt in Vancouver. Like, Matt, that's lame. This is my point. What? Somebody already made that point, Matt. So why are you just saying what somebody else already said, but not nearly as well? This is exactly what I'm saying. I've received hundreds of those already. So maybe when you think of Portland, you think of Portland woman, not me. When I think of Portland, I think about the Trailblazers. I think about tour stops. I think about station visits. I think about the Blackhawk helicopter. I think about Rashid coming to a tour stop. I think about all the calls we've had over the years. I'm telling you, if I had to rank the things that I think of when I think of Portland, if we play word association, Portland woman's not only not in the top 100, it's not on my list. Dear Romy, you don't know how elated I was to hear your voice today. I have been listening to the Corvallis affiliate through the static instead of that garbage they try to replace you with.
Garbage!
Well, I have to go cut down another 1,000 Christmas trees before lunch. Remember, Bay Area clones, support Oregon agriculture and buy a real tree. And you don't mess with the jungle. Signed, Levi in Portland. Good looking out, my man. Thank you. Dear Rome, been listening since the early days on the nifty 650 in SoCal. Glad you're bringing back the truth in PDX. Chargers suck. Raiders rule out. Bruce in the PDX, Portland's coming in so big. Feels so good. Every line is lit with a Portland call, too. Hey, Bruce, listen, good to have you back. It's good to be back. The Chargers don't suck at all. They're hot. They're an amazing story. Brian Fogel is my guest. Brian, it's great to have you on the radio now. Nice to have you back and have a conversation. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim, and it's good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. All right, so, Brian, what was your reaction first when you heard the news that the IOC was banning Russia from the 2018 Winter Olympics in South Korea after their investigation revealed a systematic manipulation of the anti-doping rules and system? First, let me get your thoughts and reaction to it.
Well, you know, as being so deeply involved in this journey and helping all along the way to provide the evidence to corroborate Gregory Rodchenkov's story, you know, I very much applaud the IOC's decision, which was an unprecedented decision to ban a country from the Olympic Games. It's never been done before for doping. There's been boycotts, but this was a truly monumental decision, and I applaud the IOC for standing up to protect the integrity of the games. And on a personal level, I feel very sad for a lot of the clean athletes around the world that were cheated and robbed of their medals for decades and decades. And for that kind of understanding of, you know, what that means to all of these athletes all over the world, to have this reality that if they competed against a Russian, it means that they were essentially being cheated. And I have a lot of, compassion for the Russian athletes as they were employees of the Russian government and the Russian ministry. and whether they knowingly took banned substances or unknowingly took banned substances. I have a lot of compassion for these athletes who will not be going to the Winter Games this year, because I know what it means to go to those Olympic Games and how hard these athletes have worked. So I think it's a very incredible moment for sport history, and that this sort of cheating is not going to be tolerated. But it's also a sad moment for a lot of athletes, and I have a lot of compassion for that.
Brian Fogel joining us. He's the director of Icarus. It's a Netflix original documentary. It's streaming there right now. Thing is, Brian, the ruling does allow Russian athletes to compete in the Olympics, but the athletes will compete under the title of Olympic athlete from Russia instead of wearing a Russian uniform and under the Russian flag. So what's your sense as to how this ban is going to be received in Russia?
You know, that's a good question. And, you know, I'm reading everything from that Russia might still boycott the games for their neutral athletes because they are still not wanting to take any responsibility for this scandal. I saw a tweet today from Vitaly Mutko, who's been banned for life from the Olympic Games. And he wrote a bleep you to Thomas Bach, the head of the IOC. So there is continued defiance on the part of Russia. So I'm not quite sure exactly how this is going to play out. And also the athlete is going to have to establish that they are indeed clean. And all of the athletes that, you know, competed in Sochi and were found to have been part of this state-sponsored system will be excluded. So I'm not quite sure exactly how the neutral athlete thing is going to play out. But regardless, those athletes will not be competing under a Russian flag. They will not be hearing their national anthem played. It is, a huge disgrace for Russia as a country, and a reckoning that this sort of cheating and behavior is not going to be tolerated.
Brian Fogel, my guest. Brian, one more thought about the so-called neutral athlete. I mean, knowing what you know about the manipulation of the anti-doping rules that have gone on for so long, how confident would you be that the Russian athletes competing under the title of Olympic athlete from Russia would in fact be clean?
That is a very difficult question to answer because, you know, not only in my journey of making Icarus and trying to evade doping controls that I see the inefficiencies and ineffectiveness of the anti-doping system, I also learned of the myriad loopholes. And so to that, I have a very hard time commenting. But unless that athlete is basically under 24/7 supervision, being tested, you know, a couple times a day for a period of 6 or 7 months, I think it is very, very, very hard to determine whether or not that athlete is clean. And then the question becomes is who is carrying out those tests? Where are those tests being carried out in? What laboratory? Under what supervision, et cetera? So it's a difficult question to answer, not only for Russian athletes, but for athletes the world over.
Now, Brian, for those who have not seen Icarus or even heard the podcast that you and I did a few weeks back, to talk about this journey, I mean, this did not start out, your journey did not start out as an investigation, of course, into the Russian doping system. It started out with you as a cyclist. So take us back for a few moments. What was your reaction when you first saw that Lance Armstrong admitted that he had taken banned substances?
Well, to me, that was not surprising. What was surprising was that when he confessed in January of 2013, he was not caught for actually failing an anti-doping test. To this day, he passed all of his tests cleanly, and all 500 of them by any estimate. He was in fact caught by his own teammates ratting him out in exchange for their own immunity as part of a federal investigation. And that is what started my journey of making this film, which is I was going, hey, if the most tested athlete on planet Earth can't be caught, what does this mean for all athletes across all sports? Because clearly, in my mind, the anti-doping system was a fraud. It didn't work. And I wanted to set out on that mission firsthand to expose that truth to the world. And what transpired was a series of events that ultimately led to Russia being banned from the Olympic Games yesterday.
We are talking to Brian Fogel. Once again, the man responsible for Icarus, which is an amazing documentary, which is streaming on Netflix. Brian, one of the arguments that some athletes will make is that banned substances are simply to help you recover from injuries and get back to participating in their sport faster. You did this. You tried them. What kind of an impact did they have on your performance?
Well, I can tell you this. If you're not a spectacular meaning if you're not a thoroughbred horse to begin with and a champion to begin with, all the drugs in the world are not going to make you a champion. That none of these drugs make up for the tens of hundreds of thousands of hours of training, of dedication, of being, you know, genetically built for that sport, of being single-minded in your focus. That these drugs do not do. But what I found was that they truly aided in recovering. And by being able to recover on a day-in and day-out basis, I was able to train harder. And by being able to train harder, ultimately, I got better and was able to be faster. But I don't believe the drugs themselves alone is the difference between what makes a champion or not a champion. But, you know, at that level of sport where people are competing for hundreds of seconds or a 1% advantage, that recovery of extra bit of power, certainly does make a difference.
Listen, they work. They work or people wouldn't use them. I really think that they make good athletes great. I think they make great athletes Hall of Famers. I think they make Hall of Famers the best ever. They certainly work. And in fact, Brian, where does this leave us? I mean, it seems like a watershed moment, but fundamentally, will it change the bottom line or is there always going to be doping in the Olympics?
Well, I think that there is always going to be doping because it is purely human nature to always want to win at all costs. And that goes across, not just sport, but politics, but business, et cetera. We're always looking as humans for that competitive advantage. And if we weren't, there wouldn't be the iPhone 10 and the iPhone 11 and the iPhone 12, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is kind of the nature of evolution. And we as humans are constantly evolving as well. So many of what is considered performance-enhancing drugs is medical science actually evolving to allow humans to be better humans in our scientific makeup. So, it's a very complicated question. But on the pure ethics of it, I hope that, athletes around the world view this as a wake-up call that these kind of behaviors and flagrant disregard for the rules are not going to be tolerated, because when you're going onto that playing field, I think there is a believing in your opponent that you are going in to compete on as level playing field as possible under the rules of that sport. And if you don't have that, then, I think it makes you question why watch sport to begin with.
Exactly right. If it's fixed, why watch it? So I was going to ask you before you go, Brian, and you mentioned the phrase that I was going to use, a level playing field. You know, it's one thing, Brian, if we're talking about an athlete or a few athletes or a group of athletes that make this private decision, but that's not what this is. This is a state-sponsored doping program. Talk about Dr. Rodchenko for a minute. For instance, if you were to ask him, what would he say to the question, how high up does this go?
Well, according to Dr. Rodchenkov, it goes to Putin. And what was ultimately the evidence that allowed for that ban of Russia in the 2018 Games was Russia had been arguing that this was Dr. Rodchenkov and that he was a sole mastermind and that the individuals were responsible and not the government. Yet the evidence that was uncovered was that Dr. Rodchenkov was corresponding on a daily basis to Vitaly Mutko, who was then the deputy sports minister for Russia. And in Russia, all sport is under the ministry, meaning all athletes in Russia are employees of the government. And Grigory's boss was the head of the sports ministry. And in the wake of the scandal, Vitaly Mutko was actually promoted to be the deputy prime minister of Russia, meaning the vice president of Russia. So Grigory's boss was the vice president of Russia, and there's only one man who Vitaly Mutko answers to, and that's Putin. So I think the IOC made their own conclusions in the spectacular amount of evidence put forward that not only was Grigory not in charge of this operation, but Grigory was answering to the ministry, and the person that he was answering to was Putin's right-hand man.
Now, he was fearful, obviously, of what might happen to him. In fact, he escaped to the United States with your help, and after that, the news broke that a friend and a colleague, Kamayev, died at the age of 52, reportedly of a heart attack, and I know that he didn't think that that's what that was. Russian officials would love to get Grigory back. He is still here somewhere. If he were to go back to Russia, what would happen to him?
Well, I think it would be one of two things. It is A, his execution, or B, a lifetime in prison. That is the one of two possible outcomes. Actually, the head of Russia's Olympic Committee a couple weeks ago called for Grigory's execution and said that he should be shot in the head like they did under Stalin. And Russia has launched all sorts of criminal charges against Grigory and have been seeking his extradition back to Russia, claiming that he is a criminal and he is under protective custody by the United States right now. So his outcome or fate in Russia, if he were to ever go back, is sealed. And in the case of Nikita Kamayev, who was running RUSADA, the Russian anti-doping agency, and who knew of this operation as Grigory, Nikita was in the early stages of writing a book. He had corresponded with David Walsh, the Sunday Times journalist who had tracked Lance Armstrong for all those years. They had arranged to meet, and the very next day, Nikita dies of a heart attack, and apparently this was a 3.5-hour heart attack. Grigory was actually on the phone to Nikita's wife as he was dying, and there is zero doubt in Grigory's mind that Nikita was murdered. There was another associate who died mysteriously a week and a half before that, and that was Nikita Kamayev's former boss, Vyacheslav Sinov. So it appears that there have been, two murders as a result of this scandal that we know of.
Brian Fogel, my guest. This is on Icarus, but all in real time. You see this play out. Brian, one last thought. We've gone kind of heavy here, but I do want to get your thoughts on this. Go ahead and be honest. No need to be modest right here. But are we having this discussion about the IOC banning the Russian Olympic Committee from the 2018 Winter Olympics if not for you and your documentary, Icarus?
100%. There would be no banning of Russia from the Olympics had Icarus not happened, had I not set out on this journey to explore the anti-doping system, meeting Grigory Rodchenkov and ultimately working with him through my incredible producing team on the film to bring this story forward. And then in the past year, since he's been in protective custody, his attorneys, Jim Walden and Avni Patel, who have been incredible in continuing Gregory's fight for the truth and working with the Olympics to make this happen. But none of this would have happened had Icarus not been made and had I not set out on this journey, which launched this incredible chain of events.
You know, Brian, I think that, and I agree with you, I think I'd be remiss, or more so, the listeners would be incredibly remiss, because I keep getting this, and I'm sure you see it on your own Twitter feed, quote, how is your guest not fearful for his own life? Are you, in fact, fearful for your life?
You know, I try not to be, because I believe that life is about making choices, and Gregory came to me with this story, and I made a choice that his truth was incredibly important to the world, and that I wanted to help him bring that truth forward. And I would always say, you know, don't kill the messenger. You know, I hope I'm not in danger, but I certainly am not planning to go back to Russia anytime soon.
Brian Fogel, my guest. Icarus is streaming on Netflix right now. It is a Netflix original documentary. It is a brilliant piece of work. Brian, so good to have you on the show. The podcast was tremendous. Hey, my man, did you get a Peloton yet?
I am in the process of getting a Peloton bike. And once I do, we're going to be racing.
No, we are not. No, we are not. Romy, I attended the University of Oregon. I bleed green and yellow. Always have, always will. I understand Willie is a Florida guy, came from a Florida school, and still has family there. But come on, man. You don't just promise your players and recruits one thing and do the complete opposite by dipping out the way he did. Hashtag Willie the Snake. Hashtag go Ducks. All right, that's pretty tough. But I understand why you're upset. Let's get into this. Because Florida State gets their guy. Now, it'd be very easy to take a shot at Tennessee here and point out that yet another vacancy that opened after theirs has been filled. But I won't do that, because that's not what I'm about. I'm all about focusing on the positive, and the positive is Willie Taggart comes to Tallahassee. And, you know, honestly, I'd be damned if I didn't say that I like that hire. Well, I'll get to the Oregon part of it in a minute. But for Florida State, I like that hire a lot. He turned around Western Kentucky. He turned around South Florida. He changed the energy at Oregon in short order. And no, it is not ideal that he's leaving the Ducks after only one season. I'm guessing if he could have drawn that up, it would have been a lot different than this. And I'd be shocked if his plan when he left South Florida was to go to Oregon for a year and then return to Florida. You know that's not the case. But that's what this is about. Returning to Florida. Coming back to Florida. Getting a chance to take over the program that he grew up rooting for back when Warrick Dunn and Amp Lee were killing it for the Noles. It's a dream job. His dream job. He knows how to recruit. He knows how to develop a culture. He knows how to win. Now, I can't guarantee that he'll be a success at Florida State and start stacking rings, because you can't guarantee that with anybody, unless your name is Saban, Sweeney, or Meyer. There's always going to be a level of question about whether or not you can reach the ultimate goal, but I can guarantee he will immediately inject some much-needed energy and enthusiasm into an FSU program that's flatlining, that mysteriously has none of that, that's fallen way back. Again, a Florida guy with Florida roots and family back in Florida that he was 3,000 miles away from. And it had to be especially painful when his father passed away a few months back. So no, I'm not going to crush him for leaving Oregon after a year. Again, it's not ideal, but it's not the way he drew it up. I'm not saying that the fans and players shouldn't be unhappy about it. I understand that. But I'm not going to crush him for it. Not ideal for him or for Oregon. But if you're wanting to compare Willie Taggart to Lane Kiffin, you don't know that much about Willie Taggart. The Florida State job has been open twice in the last four decades. If you don't take it now, you probably never get another shot. Again, this sucks for the Ducks. If I were an Oregon fan, I'd be pissed right now. You landed a good coach last year. You invested in that coach. You started to see immediate results, and then he bounces. If I'm an Oregon player, I'd probably be even more than pissed. And while I'm not going to get into the conversation about college athletes and the transfer restrictions that bind them to schools in ways that coaches are never bound, that doesn't mean that's not a thing either, because it is. If you want to argue that players should have the chance to leave when their dream school comes calling, just the way a coach can leave when a dream school comes calling, I'd listen to that argument. I mean, what's fair is fair. But if you're Florida State, you owed it to yourself to make that call to Taggart. If you're Taggart, you owed it to yourself to answer that call. It's not ideal. But let me ask you this. How many other coaches do you think in that same position, with his background and his history with that state and with that program, would not have done what he did? I got a better question. How many of you listening would not have done that? Say you're in a job. You commit to that employer. You feel pretty good about things. And then all of a sudden, your dream job comes along. Dream situation. The place, the state, the city, the location, the product, the company, the thing that you've always wanted. They offer you a job. Are you going to say, yeah, you know, I kind of committed to the other guys? If you do, you're a saint. You're great. Much respect. But look in the mirror long and hard. Would you? Would you do that? I wonder how many of you would. 1-800-636-8686. I'm not saying that's going to change anybody's mind who's a fan of Oregon right now. I'm just saying that's my thought. It's not ideal. It's not something you look forward to. But I understand why he did it, and I'm not going to crush him for it. Let's go to Portland. Jared, nice to have you on the show. Jared, what's up? Good morning.
Good morning, Romy. Hey, great to have you back in the 503, man. It's been pretty bad here without you. Anyway, a lifelong Oregon fan here. And a lot of Oregon fans out here are pretty pissed off at Willie Taggart today. I mean, what kind of weak ass move was that by him to come to Oregon after 1 year and bounce out? Look, we get it. We get it. It's his dream job, but it's the way he went about it. I mean, you just got to think he's LeBron James or something. Does he need a decision on ESPN, a 3-hour long thing? Come on, man. That's pretty weak stuff. But you know what? We'll be all right. We're a good program. I think we got to go either after Kevin Sumlin or hire from within and go with Cristobal. Hey, go Ducks, and great to have you back, Romy. Thank you.
It's good to be back. Thank you very much. All right, then. I understand why you feel that way. I'm not saying you're wrong to feel that way. Listen, I'm not an Oregon fan, per se. I didn't go to Oregon. If I went to Oregon, I bet I'd feel the same way. If I were a fan or I lived in the area and that team meant that much to me, I'd probably feel the same way. But I'm a little bit more objective, a little bit more detached. It's not ideal. It's not ideal. But I think that Willie Taggart, certainly that was not the way he drew it up. And he wouldn't draw it up like that. And I think he probably does feel pretty badly. But he's going to go now. Dream job, going back home, lost his father. And as I mentioned, that job's opened up twice in the last four decades. You don't say yes now, you're not going to get another shot at it. It is unfortunate. Not ideal for him, certainly. It's not a great look for him. Not ideal for him. Not ideal for Oregon. I understand why you're pissed. But I'm not going to crush him for it. Tom Haberstroh is my guest. Tom, it's great to have you on. How are you?
I'm good. I'm sad to report, though, Jim, that I no longer have the mustache. I just had too many people just jumping all over me, just so attracted. I'm sorry. I couldn't handle it anymore.
Dude, sucks for you, bro. That had to have been tough. That had to have been really tough. Tell me about that. For those, since you took it down, I understand why you might do that. I'm kind of sad to hear it, but why did you have it in the first place?
For No Shave November, trying to raise money for men's health and men's health awareness. And a buddy of mine asked me to do the challenge with him. So I didn't shave for the entire month of November. And then on the last day, I put it out to Twitter, which NBA player's mustache or facial hair should I emulate? And I held a raffle, and for every $10 that someone donated, they get a ticket to the raffle, and the winner picked, of all people, Scott Pollard's handlebar mustache. And so I worked really hard slaving away in the bathroom trying to emulate this thing, and I posted on Instagram, raised some money, and my wife almost divorced me over it. So It was a lot of fun.
Nice job, Tom. I see you working. And speaking as somebody who's had a goatee for a long time, there's a lot of maintenance that goes into this that people do not understand. It's not as easy as it looks, is it?
No, it's not. And a lot of it is, like, you can't go back. Like, as soon as you screw up, there's no, like, undo button, you know? So you end up being very careful around the margins. And people don't appreciate it, man. When you're working with facial hair, there is no undo button, and so you just got to live with your screw-ups.
No, I understand that. Believe me. All right, so let me ask you, and thanks for sharing that story. In terms of Steph Curry, what was your initial reaction when you heard that Steph Curry was going to miss at least 2 weeks with a sprained ankle?
Oh, not again. That was my initial feeling. But you know what? It's funny that we do this, that Steph Curry for a long time was associated with bad ankles. But his career after his surgeries in 2012, 2013, he's been remarkably consistent. In the 2013 season, he only missed four games. In the next season, only missed four games. And it's an 82-game season, so he's playing 78, 78, 80, 79, 79, and 23 in this season. So he has been remarkably durable. And I did a story for ESPN, the magazine, about this, which is in order to improve his ankle health, he didn't work on strengthening his ankles. He actually worked on strengthening his hips. And so that is the reason why he's actually been so healthy and he's put those ankle issues behind, is because he worked on strengthening his hips so that it wasn't going to be driving a lot of that force to his ankles, which can make it really bad. So this is actually an injury that used to plague him. And so far, I think they're going to take this easy. I talked to Steve Kerr today. They're in Charlotte where I'm based. And he actually said he liked this. He said, first and foremost, I'm okay. I want Steph to be healthy. I never wish injury upon anyone. But I kind of like this look that we're going to have with the team. We're going to learn a lot about ourselves. And to be honest, they haven't played well without Steph Curry. And that's crazy to say, like, oh, you lost an MVP. But really, like, this team with all the star power the last 4 years, they've been 9-7, barely 500 when Steph Curry is out of the lineup. So contrast that with KD. Last year, they went on a 14-game win streak without Kevin Durant. So they're going to miss Steph Curry probably for the next 2 weeks at least. I think he could be out for a month, and I would not buy tickets to the Christmas Day game expecting to see Steph Curry.
Mm-hmm. Tom Haberstroh joining us. Tom, finish that thought. That's really interesting that they really struggled without Steph Curry going 9-7, but without Kevin Durant, they almost didn't miss a beat. I mean, how are they different without Curry versus how they're different without Durant?
Well, Kevin Durant, he's an amazing shooter, amazing shot taker. He's one of the best one-on-one players ever. But they already have that in Steph Curry. What Steph Curry brings that KD can't or Draymond Green can't is the ability to pull up from 40 feet off the dribble and command two people on the ball so that when he makes that pass, when they trap him out at 40 feet, it's basically four on three. And that kind of pull, that gravitational pull from 40 feet out in, you can't find that anywhere else. And it's certainly not with Sean Livingston, who is a great player on its own merits, but he has no range beyond the three-point line. So, you know, it's a completely different look for the Warriors. Whereas if they have no KD, you still got great shooters, but you lose the point guard and the ability to create plays. Klay Thompson's not a playmaker in that sense. So Steph Curry really is one of the most unique players we've ever seen in the NBA, ever. And KD, you know, he's just not as dynamic as Steph is with the ball.
Tom, you recently wrote a piece for Bleacher Report that I thought was pretty fascinating on plant-based diets and the NBA players who are using them. It's a group which includes Kyrie Irving, Damian Lillard, Wilson Chandler, Al Jefferson, and more. How did this first come about?
This documentary this summer that kind of went viral, it's called What the Health? And it basically sings the virtues of vegan diets, you know, not eating meat, getting rid of dairy, not eating eggs, even honey. Believe it or not, for those who don't know, honey is not considered part of a vegan diet because it uses an animal product. And so what a lot of NBA players did this summer was they were on Netflix and they saw this documentary that is very spooky about the big meat. They equate it to basically big tobacco, and saying that a lot of our diseases are born out of our diets and eating meat. And so Kyrie Irving, he didn't say it was exactly that documentary that made him switch, but Garrett Temple, the starting point guard for the starting two guard for the Sacramento Kings, he said he was spooked by watching that documentary and it got around all the players. So you saw like a half dozen players switching to a vegan diet. And in America, just in general, 6% of Americans identify as vegan, which is up 6 times compared to what it was in 2014. So there's a huge movement happening, and it's happening with the NBA too. And Kyrie Irving, you got to say, he's been playing great in games. When you think he wouldn't have the energy, he's playing even better than his counterparts there down the stretch.
Yeah, it's a far cry, right, from those insane stories about Dwight Howard stashing candy all over his house and eating the sugar equivalent of 24 candy bars a day. I mean, so what about Kyrie and as well as he's playing? I mean, diet aside, what do you make of the way he's fit in? And I'm curious, how much of this do you think is about diet, and then how much of this is just about a change of mindset and the way he's approaching it?
Totally. I think it's both. I think he's totally changed his mindset. He's playing from scratch here in Boston, a totally clean slate. He is the number one fan of Brad Stevens. There's no one who loves Brad Stevens more, not Gordon Hayward, not anybody, than Kyrie Irving. In the post-game interviews with him, he makes it a point to shout out Brad Stevens every other word, it seems like. He just loves that guy. And you know what? Like, the diet thing, I think, is part of his entire mindset, that he's trying to play clean. He's trying to just get his mind right. And playing with LeBron James and the Cleveland, the sort of pressure you have as the number one pick and coming into that franchise, it's a totally new ballgame for Kyrie Irving. So I think the nutrition side is part of it. I mean, with his play in clutch situations this year, when you think a guy who's not eating meat, the kind of protein you get from meat, you think he would really struggle down the stretch, but he is unbelievably clutch this season and maybe the most clutch player around in the NBA. And part of it is diet. Part of it is just he knows his team. He knows what Brad Stevens wants, and he doesn't have to defer to Gordon Hayward or LeBron James. He knows this is his team.
All right, before you go, as long as we're talking about food, you're a man of many talents. You're not only doing a basketball podcast, you're busting out with a new podcast called Pack Your Knives, which is dedicated to Top Chef. If I put you on the spot right now, who is the greatest contestant in the history of Top Chef?
Why, do you watch the show, Jim?
A little bit. Of late. I'm starting to come around to it.
Well, I think Michael Voltaggio is maybe the best one of all time. He was an incredible chef. But, you know, Kristen Kish is another one who was unbelievable. Kevin Arnovitz and I, we're going to treat this Top Chef season like it's the NBA. We both have been covering the NBA for years and years and years. We're going to do analytics. We're going to do scouting, interviews. It's going to be a lot of fun. Pack your knives on leveragethechat.com.
Yeah, I love that. How will the use of analytics work with Top Chef?
Well, like, if you want to predict who's going to win the Top Chef, which everyone wants to do, when you're watching these elimination shows, whether it's Survivor or Project One Runway or Bachelor, you want to know who wins the whole thing. Well, does it matter if you win the first competition? Like, what's the most important competition in terms of predicting who's going to be the winner? And how many do you need to win the whole thing? So there's a lot of game theory with the show. You know, there's a lot of players or contestants who just dominated throughout and lost at the end. Is that what you want to do? If you want to win early, or do you want to save some energy, kind of like what LeBron James is doing, and making sure you peak at the right time? So we're going to apply all that stuff that we do in the NBA. We're going to apply it to Top Chef.
By the way, you know who I had a chance encounter with yesterday? Speaking of LA, went to see my guy, my clothier, David August. And in walks none other than 90-year-old Tommy Lasorda. So Tommy Lasorda and I had a conversation. We had a long conversation. My man's still bringing the heat. And if you're a longtime listener of this program, you remember when Tommy used to come on back in the day. Tommy at 90, sharp as hell, amazing recall, was talking about how the world has changed, social media, how everything is different right now. He, at one point, he looked at me and he was telling, let me tell you something, my man, he should be on the podcast, Hawk. My man was spewing F-bombs at 90. Lot of fire still. He literally looked at me at one point and goes, Jim Rome, man, I wanted to kick your ass back in the day. I'm like, Tommy, what are you talking about? You loved me back in the day. You always came on the show. He laughed. If I'm not mistaken, back in the day when we had celebrity guest hosts, I think that he may have even did it back in the day. I know Mike Piazza and Eric Harris did. Anyway, I could not believe Tommy. His recall, he was so anecdotal. He was telling crazy stories, great stories. And he still bleeds Dodger blue. He was talking about his birthday party, his 90th birthday party. He had this amazing bash where, in fact, I think it was at the Getty Center, which is having a tough day today. In fact, my thoughts are with everybody in L.A. That is a densely populated area where the fires are burning right now. They shut down the 405 freeway. If I'm not mistaken, that's probably the busiest freeway in the country. And many of us here in L.A. drive that freeway or drove that freeway. So my thoughts are with everybody there for sure. But he was telling me about the birthday party he had at the Getty and that he had 300 or 400 people there. And I said, who came? He said, everybody came. I said, did the Penguin come? He said, of course the Penguin was there. It's my guy Ron Say, my hero growing up. So that was a tremendous chance encounter. Of course, Tommy Lasorda had the classic take on golf on this show way back in the day. Before you play this album, is there even a date for this? This predates most things. In fact, we don't even have a date. Tommy Lasorda said this about golf on this show back in the day.
You tell me it's easier to hit that ball that's coming at you 90 and 100 miles an hour than hit that little white ball that's standing still? You know what I don't understand? Here's a guy playing golf, and a guy coughs. Hey, shh, shh. And the announcer goes, now, ladies and gentlemen, he is now going to hit off this tee. It's 425 yards. The guy standing up at the plate, hitting off of Nolan Ryan, throwing the ball 95 miles an hour, and 50,000 people are screaming. And you tell me it's easier to hit a baseball than to hit that golf ball? What's the matter with you?
So that's how that came up. We were talking about the hardest thing to do in sports. The hardest thing to do in sports is to hit a baseball, right? Most would agree. And somehow golf came into the equation like, hey, no, golf is really hard. Playing golf is hard. And anybody who's ever picked up a bat or a golf club knows that playing golf is really hard. Not harder than hitting a baseball coming at you and moving 100 miles an hour. To Tommy's point, that little white ball is sitting still on a tee. Try and hit a baseball coming at you with crazy movement 100 miles an hour. So that was Tommy way back in the day on this show. So that was really random. Really random. We had another time where Tommy came on where somebody buzzed his line from Larry King's show trying to book him while he was doing this show.
Houston had said that, you know, that you weren't coming back. I said, well, if that's what they say, then you go ahead and write it.
Right.
Because I had not made a decision. So nobody knows. Nobody could have said anything with real proof. You see what I mean, Jim?
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Tommy. That would really rock everybody's world. That was a hell of a tribute to you.
Rick Bell operator, have an emergency call. 870-4894
no,
from
can't.
Larry King Live. Do you want to release?
Who's it from?
Larry King Live.
No, I can't. Tell him to call me back.
Thank you.
An emergency breakthrough. How's that for old school? And how about Larry King? I mean, emergency breakthroughs are if somebody's about to die, right? Something really bad happened. Somebody is bleeding out in the street. Somebody stroked out. Something terrible happened. At least that was always my understanding about an emergency breakthrough. You don't do that to somebody unless it's life and death. Yet some producer for Larry King back in the day was trying to buzz Tommy Lasorda, was getting a busy signal, went to the operator old school, and went emergency breakthrough. And it happened during a conversation that we had on this show. There was no call waiting back then. There was no call waiting back then. Hell, there were no cell phones back then. That came off a hard line. See what I'm saying? Tommy had great history with this show. So when Tommy says to me to my face yesterday, Jim Rome, man, I wanted to kick your ass back in the day. I mean, maybe get in line, but maybe. It was so good to see Tommy. So Tommy was talking to David August, and David August obviously is the clothier of the stars. He's got his own line with Conor McGregor now, and he hooks up a lot of people you see on TV. Whenever I see a guy on TV in sports wearing a certain suit and it looks really sharp, I know that's my guy David August. Important enough that Tommy Lasorda made the road trip down to see him to talk about his gear. So that's how sharp Tommy's game is at 90. My man still cares. Tommy still understands, look good, feel good, feel good. Do whatever it is he does now. Well, hope I got that game at 90. That's it, clones. Wednesday in the books already. The Jim Rome podcast with Gary Vaynerchuk is waiting on your phone. Trust both podcasts. Be back here tomorrow for more. I'll see you then. I'm out.